We stayed there quite a while, 9 years in fact. Now, was there anything else you wanted to ask about that?
I was going to ask you, Mr. Brooks, Paul, when you and your wife went to teach at Point Barrow.
No, she didn't go to teach at Point Barrow.
Well, where did you go to that time when Mr. Brooks was going?
To Nome?
Was it Nome?
We were going to Nome, yeah. But she had a job teaching at Cayenne.
Oh, I see.
Now, should it... just shut it off a minute. How'd I get to there?
When you folks went to take this job teaching at Cayenne...
At Selwick.
Oh, Selwick, pardon me. Did you go by small boat at that time?
Well, we left Candle, because Candle is about 12 miles up the river. And so we took a small boat down to the sea, and there we chartered, in fact we had wired ahead for this boat to meet us there, a whale boat that is built for carrying a few passengers, and we chartered this. We chartered this boat, although at the same time there was a big freighter standing right off Key Wallach, and my wife wanted me to go out and see if we could go on that big freighter. She didn't think too much of chartering this this small boat because it was pretty rough seas there at times. Well, I went out and looked at the freighter, and I asked them, where would be our quarters here on this freighter? And he said, come on, I'll show you. And he went up about three decks up near his pilot house. There was no railings, and there was no railings at all out where he showed us where our quarters would be. And I said, oh, that's it. We had three small babies. And I said, no, I cancel this out right now. So I went back and I told my wife, I said, no, I said, we'll take the whale boat, I think. And the first day we got out, we hit a storm we hadn't been more than about a half an hour out, and we had a storm, a real rough storm. So it was pretty rough, and the kids was all getting sick. So I told him, I said, you better hit in behind that island. I forget what they call that island. There's an island anyhow that's in between Key Wallach and Trotsville, and we stayed there all night. And the next morning it was quiet, so we went on to Kotzebue, and we stayed over in Kotzebue, and that's where the superintendent's office was, and he had they were teaching school there too. His wife was teaching school there, in Kotzebue, Mrs. Morlander. And so the next day or so, we started for Selwick, and we had to go around through what we call Cobuck Lake, and then there's a narrow strip of water going into Selwick Lake, and then we went into we go through that narrow strip of water, and about the time we got there, where the engine on the boat started to give the fellow trouble, so we camped out on the beach. He says, "Now fix this boat." And I said, "What are you going to do to it?" He says, "Sawman too." He says, "Too long now?" It was a two-cylinder engine. He called it too long, and he says, "I'm going to saw them two and just use one lung." Well, I says, "Do you think you can do it?" "Oh yes." He says, "Yes, I can do it all right." So we stayed out on the beach, and in fact, we was out there a whole day, and we camped right out on the beach, and I didn't pay much attention to him. And finally, he got it sawed in two all right. All he needed done was connect the crankshaft. He wouldn't need the sawed in two, just connect the crankshaft, but he didn't know that. And in fact, I didn't pay much attention to him. I thought he knew what he was doing. Well, anyhow, he got this sawed in two, and then he got it out of time, and he didn't know how to put it back in time again. And he was looking at me. He'd get a pop out of it every once in a while, and I said, "Well, you having trouble?" I went down there to see what he said. "Yeah," he says, "can't get him to spark right." Well, I said, "Is that the only trouble?" "Yeah," he says, "that's the only trouble." So I set the valves on it and fixed it up. So I said, "Oh, I'll try it." And then it went pop, pop, pop right off. And he says, "Now we've got one lung. We'll make it all right." Well, it ran, but it only went about 6 miles an hour, where before we were making about 10 or 12. But anyway, we crossed the lake. It was dark then when we got this fixed. We crossed the lake in the dark. And we camped on a spit right at the mouth of the Selwick River, because it was too dark to even, really pitch dark, it was too dark to even find the mouth. It was a hard time even finding this spit that we camped on. And then the next morning when we got daylight, we went on up to the village. But that was that. I'd like to make a correction of the write-up made by an interview that I had as a reporter for the Newsminer. Anyone reading that article would get the impression that all I did there was fight Eskimos. Now, it's not the case that he either got the wrong impression or he just embellished it on his own hook. Now, the Eskimos are fine people, and when you move into any village, whether it's Eskimo or white people, you're going to have a few bad ones. And I had to contend with those bad ones. But that's not saying that the whole people that way. The most of the people are the finest that you run across. They were very fine people, and we got along fine with them. But I did have several run-ins. In fact, when we was arguing one day over the model reindeer this fellow had, he got madder and madder, and finally he says, "Well, one way we can settle it is you come out in the yard and we'll fight it out." I says, it wouldn't do any good. And I couldn't talk him out of it, so he dashed out the door and went out into the yard, and I went out there. He had his dukes up, and "Come on," he says, "and fight." So I just grabbed his fists and twisted them up so he couldn't do anything and held him tight, because I was much stronger than he was. And says, "Well, don't you think you've got enough fight now?" And finally he says, "Yeah, you call a fight off." He says, "That's all. That's a tera." Tera means that's enough in Eskimo.
You know a lot of Eskimo words.
I do know quite a lot of Eskimo words. I remember a few. In fact, our children, our oldest daughter could talk fluently with the Eskimos, and I used her for an interpreter quite often because there's so many old people there at that time.
Put a phrase on there in Eskimo and then translate it right behind it. Put a phrase on the tape.
I really don't know enough of it to make phrases. Now, I've forgotten the makeup of phrases, but sometimes one word will be a whole sentence. And as I mentioned in that write-up, the Eskimo language is a universal language, not like the Indians. And so if you learn the Eskimo language from one village, it might be a little variation, but not enough to that you couldn't understand what the person means, you know. A little variation from one village to another. In fact, I might as well mention this here to give you an idea. I made a trip across the Arctic Ocean. That was in 1935. I had a boat built for traveling in the ocean, and I took one of those Eskimos with me. We went from Selavik to Nome, and then we went all around the different villages, Eskimo villages, where we'd stop, and he talked fluently with every Eskimo village. And at the time when we got to the Cape, they put on a big show there for us, and a grand reception. And he talked fluently with all those Eskimos. So I'll give you an idea that the Eskimo language is universal. And so I asked him then, I says, "Do you understand these Eskimos very well?" "Oh yes," he says, "all the same language." He says, "Oh, some words a little different, not much," he says.
Now, can you describe an Eskimo wedding as I saw it myself years ago over there by the Russian Orthodox priest there?
No.
See, I went to one of those weddings that lasted a week.
They have, down through the many years, the Eskimos have had different ways of marriage. Now, while we were there, there was a church there called the Friends Church. And most all the Eskimos went to that church, and they were married in that church. And the ministers were Eskimo ministers. Of course, there was always a friend missionary there too. But the Eskimos did the preaching and did the marrying and all that.
Did you not remember these priests then much about them? Russian prisoners?
No, no, they're not in our country, none in that country.
Well, the ones that I met in the Bering Sea at Nusagat, Magnum, and Billingham used to travel by dog team and make 300 to 400 mile trips in the winter.
That's true. I know those priests down along that...
Below Nome.
That's right. That's a different, that's a different setup. It's a different church. But this church where we were, in fact, the Kotzebue and all that, Barrow and all that northern country, was controlled at that time by the Friends Church. And they didn't have any use for us teachers, is another thing.
Well, that Friends Church is a Russian...
No, no. No, the Friends Church is a Quaker church.
The Quaker church.
Yes, sir. That's a part of the Quaker church anyway. No, they are. They're weddings that we had there. Speaking about weddings, every once in a while, a young fellow would come in and say, "I want to get married." They go, "Oh, yeah? Well, what about it?" "Well, I want to borrow $10. That's what it costs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they'd, most of them had to go to Kotzebue to the commissioner
to perform
the ceremony. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, every one of them paid back those $10, and that was one thing that they complained. They always treated as sacred. And also, if you loaned them money for a funeral or anything that they needed at the funerals, you could always be sure you'd get that money back. So that was a...
I learned the same thing.
That was a sacred loan.
Mm-hmm.
And first, one of the traders there, when I started loaning these fellows money to get married on, one of them says, the first time he says, I said, "You'll never see that money again, no." I said, "Well, I'll take a chance on it anyway, but I never lost a dollar."
Well, I know that's true from what my experience over there.
And $10, that was the wedding. Cost of the wedding.
Is it true, though, that a few years back, that the Eskimos over in that area often just moved in, and then when they come to the recording district, they record the fact that they got married?
None of that happened while I was there. I heard of it, all right. I've heard that they did do that, but all the young fellows there that wanted to get married, almost every one of them came to me to get money to go to Kotzebue.
Well, there was a German man by the name of Homer that lived at Mountain Village. He's dead now. He told me a little about that. He's a German boy.
About those marriages?
Yes.
Oh, well.
And of course, the priest at Nusagat told me quite a bit.
Well, it'd probably be a different procedure in marriage down in the lower part of, say, the north.
Down towards the chain.
Down towards the chain, that'd be a different procedure. In fact, as soon as you get down near the chain, you get into the Aleuts. Now, as I understand it, the Eskimo settlements go about as far as the mouth of the Kuskokwim River. There's the Eskimos there too, and even up to Kuskokwim is mostly Eskimos. And from there on, the mouth of the Yukon and all those rivers, Unalakleet, and all up then from there on, is all Eskimos.
The origination of the Eskimos is a supposition of fact, to your knowledge, that they migrated from Mongolian countries into there.
That is my deduction. I've studied them quite a bit. In fact, all the time I was there, I studied this Eskimo psychology. That's the workings of their mind. And I've read quite a bit about the Mongolians. And as near as I can compare them, they compare nearer to the Mongolian race than any others. But in fact, especially these natives that's up there, they're large natives, very large. Some of them are over, many of them are over 6 feet, and a 6 foot native is not uncommon at all. So that compares with the large Mongolian people. And they have the same habits of nomads, you know. They like to move around. They get tired of one place, you know, and they move around quite a bit. And we studied their ways there quite a bit. In fact, I made quite a few write-ups there for the school, and I have some copies of them now. I think there'll be one come out in a magazine sometime here later. I don't know. One woman, she said she'd put it in the Well,
anything you'd like to ask
about? Well, getting back to Rome again, for a while, I was going to ask you if you ever knew any of these colorful characters, or maybe they had left Rome before you got there, but arrived there, rather. Did you ever know of, did you know Rex Beach?
I didn't know Rex Beach, but I never met him, that is to know him. But I've been, that is when I got there, well, that is shortly after I got there. You see, Nome was a pretty lively place, so that's a long time back to remember people. But I remember, I can tell you one thing. I remember counting the saloons there, and the dance halls had closed down. Some society or someone got in there and had a little throw, and they closed the dance halls down. But the gambling and the saloons were open, and I counted 11 saloons right there on Front Street, and just that many gambling halls. Some of the gambling halls were in the back of the saloon, and some of them were upstairs where the old dance halls were. And if you're not satisfied with one gambling house, you could go to another. There was 11 of them.
You didn't happen to know Tex Rickard or Judge Noyes?
I met Tex Rickard, but I never met Judge Noyes. I met Tex Rickard there before he left, and I knew some of his partners. I just can't recall their name right now.
You don't remember Lou Bandages?
No, I don't remember him.
You used to take entertainments around.
Well, those fellows, you see, I didn't get there until 1904, and those fellows, most of them left. In fact, I think Tex Rickard left just about the time I got there, shortly afterwards. But I was in his gambling house. He had a partner there by the name of Frank Hall, and I got pretty well acquainted with Frank Hall. And in later years, I used to go around there and gamble a little there myself, and Tex Rickard was there with Frank Hall. They were partners there. So,
you ever remember the Fleeters? Yeah, Fleeter Brothers, F-L-E-D-E-R, Fleeter Brothers.
No.
They were in Nome to start, or in Dawson to start, and then went down to Nome, went out to Seattle. They had a saloon in Seattle for many, many years.
Well, it's a long time to remember back now, you see. That's back quite a way, wasn't it? How long? 57 years?
Yeah.
And many of those fellows that I know, there's just a few of them that stand out, that I had kind of some experience with them, you know, like,
we're kind of in between the Klondikers and the...
Well, there was a lot of the Klondikers come down there then, you know, see? And I'm kind of pretty poor to remember names. Now, I know different fellows now that I want to think of, and I can't think of their names. But, like there's one fellow there, maybe I can think of his name while I'm telling it, but the fellow that opened up the, what they call a sourdough roadhouse on Dexter. That was written up by, that author you just mentioned?
Beach,
yeah. He was written up. I knew him pretty well, and the first time I met him was in the Hunter Saloon. And I went broke up one of these gambling houses, and I came down to this fellow, and so I can't think of his name now, and it seems like if I won, I know his name as well as I knew my own, but I just can't think of it. So he said, how much you want? Well, I said, just give me $5. Huh? I want to go and have breakfast. I gambled all night. So I met that fellow, and he's a very prominent fellow. He afterwards went to Ruby when the strike was made there, and he got a store there. And now he's living in Los Angeles. I think he's around, must be close to 90, or in his 90s now. But he still goes to the Yukon, Alaska convention.
Alaska Yukon convention, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's one of the prominent old timers in it. I can't think of his name. Well, anyway, what else did you want to? You wanted to say if I knew any more of the names there. Well, it's hard for me to remember. Probably an hour from now, I'll probably remember some of those names, but it's just too far back.
Time's catching up with all of us.
Yeah, it's just too far back.
You see, even your talking reminds me of things that I knew, and the people I met that come out from dust. You see?
Yeah.
Well, it's been very nice talking to you, Mr. Kirkpile, and this information and history you've given us about the old timers and the ways of life in the Nome country in the early days will be kept for the future generation of pioneers, I hope. And we thank you very much for your time.
Well,
it'll do some of the folks some good someday.
Well, they may not dig into them during our time, but Mr. Parkerfile, we're leaving a lot of stuff for somebody to work on.
Yeah, that's it. Of course, you can't get it all in just this short time. You get a few things in.
So what are your plans for the future to take off on
this? To take off my plans for the future?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm trying to promote the mining deal out in the Alaska Range. My partner and I have been working out there now for 13 years on this property. And it's a very promising property. I've had a lot of engineers go out and look at it. But and I've contacted many mining companies outside. In fact, every year I go outside, I always go around and visit some of them and see if they still have a notion to take it up. But nearly all of them claim it's too isolated, there's no roads to it. And said, what can we do there? What are we going to do with the ore? Well, the ore has to be, there has to be some transportation there if the ore isn't any good, although our run of ore runs about $200 a ton and could be shipped if there's a road in there, but it's at a profit. But there's no road to get machinery in, there's no land. They point all that out to me.
Now we're getting to the end of the tape, so I'll terminate. This is the end of part one of reel number two, and I'll turn the reel over for the finish of this story.
This is the second side of reel number two of Mr. Parkerfile's story, and on finishing up this tape, he's going to give us a little insight in things that the Eskimos did for entertainment in the way of their feats of strength and other entertainment. He'll continue now.
Well, ever so often, we'd have an athletic meeting, and there'd be contests from all, mostly the men. Sometimes the women would participate. But I would say they had maybe about four times a year, they'd have these athletic meetings and contests of speed and snowshoe races and running and high kicking and many different kinds of feats of strength. They seem to go in for more feats of strength than anything. And generally when the champion come along, I didn't even try for their speeds. They're like a high kick, I couldn't do that, and their shoe races, I didn't even contest on any of that, but they'd come around and challenge me. Generally the winner of the feats of strength would always challenge me. Well, I never lost to one of them in all the years of there, but every once in a while they'd come in and spring a new one on me. One that I'd never heard of before, but I never lost any contest with them on feats of strength. And probably that is one of the reasons why that I had quite a lot of respect for him, and that they had quite a lot of respect for me. But I never abused it though. Now talk about their activities at different holidays. Now like Halloween, they didn't know anything about Halloween, and I didn't tell them because I didn't want them to have two big days in a year. But at New Year's, they took on the same activities that most people do in Halloween. Now they'd play tricks on each other and ring bells and do all the same things that you do on Halloween, you know. In fact, they'd go in a house where there was one of the Eskimos would be probably lying on a couch or on a bed, and they'd pick him up and take him out in the river and leave him out in the river for a while. So that's just one of, you know.
Just pranksters,
and they'd come around and ring the school bell, and One night, the New Year's night, they come hollering to the teacher. They call me Agalati. That means teacher in Eskimo, Agalati. Agalati, Agalati, and I came out to see what all the trouble was. They'd been ringing the bell. I didn't pay any attention to that. And about three or four of them, they grabbed me and hoisted me right up over their head. And there might have been five or six. I couldn't even say how many. There were so many on the sides, there must have been about two or three dozen, I guess. And they were all hollering and making lots of noise, and here I was way up in the air. And they sashayed me around the schoolyard for a little ways ahead and come back and set me down on the porch of the schoolhouse just like and nothing had happened. No harm done at all. But that's that idea of having fun on New Year's night.
But it's not destructive fun, like the kids today.
No, they didn't do any destructive fun like the kids
today. It was all in the spirit of
goodwill. It was all in the spirit of goodwill. As I mentioned before, the best people are they're very fine people. And they don't go in for any destructive. They're only I might mention here that, and this is my opinion, of course, that there's less bad ones, and you can take it from the young ones to the big ones, than what you'd find in a white community. But there are a few bad ones, which, say, maybe out of that village of 350, I'd say, well, probably maybe two or three or four, then at the most, would be what you'd call bad eggs.
Outlaw.
Yeah, bad eggs.
Mm-hmm. And that is in almost every race, Richard.
That's every race, yeah. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're way under the percentage of bad ones. I'd say take it through all the races, all through the world, you can take almost 10%. Take a cross section through all the world.
Run that high among the Eskimos.
Oh no, it wouldn't run. I don't think it went over 1%. No, it wouldn't. Yeah, about maybe 1%, maybe 2%.
Their expression or their let off of steam, you might say, is confined to having fun.
That's right. The Eskimo is a very jolly sort of a fellow. Is he? Lots of things. In fact, most everything he'll take it as a joke, you know.
Mm-hmm. Everything's funny.
Everything's funny. Yes. Mm-hmm. Like one time, there was an Eskimo come there, and we stand out in the yard and I was talking with him, and one of Archie Ferguson's, the first plane he had, was coming flying over, and there was a lot of smoke coming out behind. Mm-hmm. And I says to him, I says, "Look, smoke behind." And he never got over that. Every time we'd see a plane with it, he'd point to it, smoke behind. And he'd go, smoke behind. Mm-hmm. Even when he was out in the rain, they heard, you know. In fact, all Eskimos, they got to use that expression then. And the Eskimos, when the deer would be running fast, "Look, smoke behind."
Well, do they take to a white man's instruction and regret easily? Are they easily guided?
Oh, to some extent. Now here, I'll give you an idea. Probably I didn't mention this before, but shortly after I came to Selwick, I organized the council, and the board of directors and the reindeer were already organized, and all we had to do was we had an election about once a year under the board of directors. But that council, I organized that council to take care of all little misdemeanors around through the village, you see, because we had no authority on what I created myself. That's it. And they appointed a marshal, and any misdemeanors, the marshal would grab them, and sometimes he'd sentence them himself. I don't just remember now how if the crime was very serious, the meeting was called, the council was called, and to decide what to do with them. In fact, most of the cases that was, they'd call the council because they all lived there nearby, and they did decide what to do with them. Now, like one fellow, I forget now what he did now, but it was just a small misdemeanor. So the council decided that he'd cut three cords of wood for no wood or room and all that and deliver it, and that is his
punishment.
And shortly after I was there was a fellow coming down the river, and his lead dog got loose, and there was a girl just coming across the river, because about half the village lived on each side of the river, and she was coming across to school, and just the time she got there, this lead dog jumped her and tore her parky off, and she had, if it hadn't been some of the other Eskimos there, he'd have killed her. He was a big husky, you know. They're very vicious dogs, most of those Eskimo dogs.
They're about half wild.
Oh yeah, they have to keep them tied, or I said they're very vicious. Well, the reason why I guess keeping them tied, of course, helps make them vicious, but they're just a natural vicious animal, very vicious. And I just like that dog, we have no business. But he saw her running, and he jumped her, and the time they got there, she was terribly bitten up, and she was out. She was prostrate.
Did they destroy a dog that does that?
Well, that come up in the council. Mm-hmm. I went right away over. They called me right away, and of course I was the acting doctor there. If anything happened, anybody got cut or chewed up or something like that, they called me. So I took my instruments and iodine and one thing and another, went over, and there was something like 12 20 different deep gashes right in through her back and through her legs and through her arms. Some of them, the flesh was flopped over even. Some of them I had to suture up after I treated them. They were torn so badly, I had to sew them, some of the big cuts. That dog must have had awful sharp teeth, the way he slashed it, just like you take a knife sometimes and stuff. But the deep cuts, I treated with the iodine, went into the bottom of every hole that he made with the iodine and treated it up and fixed it up. It was terribly painful, I guess, while I was operating on it, but then I told the parents, I said, put her to bed, and I didn't know just how she's going to come out, but I told her not to let her move. Well, in 2 weeks, that girl was back to school. And I asked her, I says, did you ever have any pain from the time I operated on you? And she said, no, I never felt anything after that.
That's good, huh?
Yeah. But that was one of the many operations that I did there.
And how did the council vote on this dog?
Oh, yes, to come back to that. They were going to censure this man that owned the dog, and I was sitting on every council meeting, too. And they said, well, the man couldn't help that. But he had no business having a vicious dog like that. So that come down. So I said, well, I tell you, the easiest way to settle this is for that man to shoot that dog.
And so they decided the man had to shoot the dog, but he wouldn't shoot the dog. So it went on for 3 or 4 days, and I asked if the dog had been destroyed, and they said no. So I told the marshal, I says, you go over and either shoot, if you don't want to shoot the dog, you shoot him. So I don't remember now whether he did or the marshal shot him, killed him. So that's
the way they settled that kind of.
That's the way that was settled.
Mm-hmm.
Now of course there's many other problems that come up there. Now like some of them had, as I mentioned before, they had some different kind of funny ideas. They never liked Eskimo from another village to come in and marry one of their Eskimo girls from the Sullivan village.
They were slightly clannish.
They were clannish that way, yeah. They didn't want them to come in. So there was a fellow there. He was courting the girl that we had hired for a maid. In fact, she looked after our son David right after he was born there. David was born there in that schoolhouse. And she was looking after, and she stayed with us through all of the years we were there. And this fellow come over there and was courting her. Well, he didn't pay any attention about it, but he was from another village. I forget now what other village it was. Well, anyhow, the council held a meeting and was going to drive this man out. There was one fellow there called, well, I'll mention his name, Billy Neelick was his name, Neelick or something like that. Anyhow, he wasn't a young fellow either. He was long about a middle-aged man, but he wanted keep up the old customs, keep our outsiders out of marrying in their village. So Fred come to me and he says, I guess I got to go. I says, well, what makes you think that? Well, he says, the council's decided I have to go. I can't take Clara. So, I says, I will fix that. So we had another meeting and I explained to them that wasn't the right thing to do. And I had to do quite a bit of talking to them. That wasn't the right thing to do. I says, this girl and this boy love each other. And I says, you're making a big mistake by chasing him away. And I finally, I talked to them to let them stay, and they got married.
They did get married, yes. Everything turned out,
and they raised quite a few children. I think he died about a few years ago, but they got quite a few children. I think they raised about 7 or 8 children. They're all grown now. Some of them are grown. Oh, they're grown and have children of their own now. In fact, she's a grandmother. Well, that's just an... you asked how the council worked. That, would that give you an idea?
That does, and that is very interesting.
Yeah.
That is something that's missing in many of these stories.
Yeah.
You rarely hear what you're
And going back to the school again, a lot of people might wonder just what are these schools accomplishing out in this wild bush, these native schools. Well, to give you an idea, I taught from the 3rd to the 8th. My wife taught from she took kindergarten, 1st grade, and 2nd grade. But she had more pupils than I did. And she had the worst job by far. She had the toughest job. To go on with this, after they got to the 8th grade, I graduated them to a school called, it was at Gluten, I think, at that time.
At
Klutna?
Yeah,
but they moved it.
Down here by Anchorage.
Well, I think they moved it now. Yeah. They got it someplace else, but it was at Klutna.
Yes.
And I don't remember all the ones that graduated through that school to go on to higher education, but I can tell you a few of them. There was one, and what they did. There's one called Irene Frost. She was, I think, the first one I graduated from there. And later on, I heard she was a clerk in the Office of Indian Affairs in Seattle. And I don't really have to come up, but she'd have a different name now. She's probably different married. Another one is our Minnie Kayana, and she's the granddaughter of Chief Kayana that founded Kayana. You heard about Kayana. And she's still living here. And she probably has a son either in high school or probably finished high school by this time. And of course she's got another name now. It wouldn't be Minnie Kayana. She's married. She had another name. But and then there's Laura Kayana, her sister. I met her known when we were up there, you know, and I had a long talk with her.
I
was 59. Yeah, I had a long talk with her, and she was so glad to see me. And she is a clerk in one of the government offices there. So I'll just give you an idea how these people, if they think, well, some people think, well, maybe they're not worth educating, or they're too hard to educate, but they're going on, and some of them are going right on and in the university out here, right out here now, the University of Alaska.
It does prove that they have exceptional intelligence.
They sure do. Now, the first going off in the teaching, I don't know if you asked that question or not, the hardest thing was to get them to understand the English language. And they always wanted to talk Eskimo there among themselves. But we had a rule, when they're on the school grounds, they had to talk English. And of course, we couldn't control them after they're off the school grounds. And that helped. And another thing that helped is our children helped teach them English probably more than we did. And as soon as they start to get the meaning of the English language, they start to learn fast. And so you can realize yourself, if you didn't know a language and try to study in that language and you didn't know very much about it, it would be awful hard for you to understand what was going on with it. Well, same with them. That's the greatest drawback that they have, is not knowing the language. But I think at this time, this stage, now they're probably... most of them are able to comprehend the English pretty well. And in fact, I notice a lot of them writing up for the paper. You see them, their names in the paper where they write from different villages now, the Eskimos.
They may not have the grammar just exactly right, but
well, they get the thought. They have the meaning, and they get the thought there, you see.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Birkbaugh, you must be kind of getting tired. I'm going to ask you just one more question. You spoke of you acting as doctor. Did you ever have any major deal in the line of surgery or anything like that from your experience with Eskimos?
Yes, I had probably, I don't know if you'd call this major or not, but the toughest one I had there was a woman trying to commit suicide. And it's immaterial what she tried to do it for, but anyhow, she tried to commit suicide, and she had a .30-30 rifle, and she put it right under her chin, and when she reached down to pull the trigger, instead of going up through her head where she thought it would go, it went right up from her throat up and come out back of her ear, and it missed all the main blood vessels, but it tore away all the skin and the flesh and everything. And when they called me for that time, I went down there, because I had a surgical kit that I worked with and all kind of medicines. She was lying on the floor, knocked out. And her husband was sitting over in the corner, kind of moaning and crying. And he kept looking at her, and he looked back and forth, and he says, you can't help her. She's dead. No, I said, I don't think she's dead. I felt her pulse, and I says, no, she's dead. So I started working on her. But I worked 3 hours. I had a woman there, she was Mrs. Blankenship. In fact, I think you probably might have heard of Mrs. Blankenship. She was the storekeeper's wife. And she had quite a bit of training in nursing. And generally, when I had a case like that, or some bad, I would always call on her. She was always willing to come and help me. So I fixed her up. I had to pull out flesh back and suture it. the layman will call it sewing, probably, I guess, and pull the skin back and suture that. I worked on her 3 hours, and she was out cold all that time. And every once in a while, this husband sitting over in the corner is still whining and crying. He says, "Oh, you're doing all your work for nothing." He says, "I've shot many animals. I know when they won't live. I know when they won't live." No, I said, "Just wait and see." So after I got her all fixed up, I did everything I could do, and I thought that was the best job I could do. It was a hard struggle. It was a hard thing to do, you know, because the skin was so much shot away that it was hard to pull it back, and the flesh was shot away, and I had to pull that in. And where the bullet went through in back of the ear, I had to swab all that out so there wouldn't be any infection. And I said, I brought some pneumonia with me, and I said, "Now, Jimmy," I says, "do you want to see whether your wife is alive or not?" And I put this pneumonia up to her nose, and she just jumped right up right away, you know. And no, she didn't.
No?
No, it didn't. And surprising, it hadn't affected her physically hardly at all. It's just the shock. It had been a terrible shock to her, you see, and she was out cold all this time, this 3 hours. I didn't need any anesthetic at all.
And that was a strange thing, too.
No, I didn't need any anesthetic. Well, she never knew what happened. And then as soon as she sat up, she started to sit right up, and she says, "What happened to me?" That was the first thing she asked me, "What happened to me?" And I said, "Well, don't worry about what happened to you." So I got some dog teams, and they took her down to Pasadena, and the nurse down there brought her back in about 3 weeks. And I looked at her, and I said, "Well, gosh sakes," I said, "that's the same work I put in. Didn't the doctor change that?" And she said, the nurse said, "No, the doctor couldn't improve on it." He could have, all right, but it had been very expensive. You see, what he'd have to do was graft and graft. It had been a very long, drawn-out deal. You see, he'd have to graft it so much skin.
You got just about 1 minute.
It just twisted her face a little bit slightly, that is all. And was there any other questions? Did that answer the questions? You want to know what I did about the medicals?
Now, I'm going to terminate this. And Mr. Parker Powell, this is very interesting, and I'm sure that in later years, this will help establish some of the early day life here that we're trying to preserve. And in the room here with Mr. Parker Pyle is
Frank Young.
And Harry Hughes. What's your name, sir?
Colin
Towns. Come on over here close.
This is my grandson, Colin Towns.
Go up closer. Say your name very clearly.
Colin Towns.
Mm-hmm. You're Mr. Parker Pyle's grandson?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Parker Powell, now I'm going to run a little bit of this back so you can hear it. And is there any other wishes that you'd want on this?
Would you allow some portion of this tape to be used for research at the university if it become convenient to do so?
Just take care of it.
That would be your wish.
That'd be my wish.
There's very many points you brought out in here that are very important.
If there's anything that would be of any benefit to the University of Alaska, I certainly...
And be your wish to be used that way.
It'd be my wish to be used. Yes.
And otherwise, it's property of Igloo 4.
That's right. I might add the system has changed for the teachers that went out and go out into the, and now people might not understand that. But in the early days, every teacher that went to a station was supposed to do this medical work, and of course they were not all. Fitted for it, but they did the best they could. Mm. They had the supply of medicines and tools and everything like that.
Well, this is October the 22nd, 1961 in Fairbanks, Alaska, and this is the Igloo 4 tape recording terminating for this afternoon. We thank Mr. Parker Powell for his time and his efforts and his knowledge. This is how he was recording.